This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. This story is from our episode about cybercrime. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. The first truly global cyber attack happened 25 years ago. It sort of ushered us into this new age of online threats and gave us a preview of just what was possible. Grant Hill reports on a virus that spread like wildfire, much to the surprise of the people who created it.
In the morning of May 4th, 2000, the U.S. Army was under attack. It started around 6:45 when technicians at Fort Bragg in North Carolina got word from two other bases that something was up with their computer networks. The issue was quickly narrowed down to the email server of the Army's largest command. Something was spreading amongst its 50,000 users. Exactly what it was, no one really knew. But just an hour later, the server was completely overloaded and taken offline. A local radio station was broadcasting reports of some kind of worldwide computer virus, one that had just paralyzed the communications of a large chunk of the U.S. military. Jeff White was working for an internet company back then. He now reports on cybercrime. He says in 2000, the tech world had just gotten over a major, potentially scary hurdle. Y2K.
The big concern around this time was the Millennium bug, the Millennium fault, which was moving from 1999 into 2000. There was a concern, and it was a legitimate concern, that computers might struggle with that changeover.
He says back then, most people in tech worried more about computer glitches than targeted attacks.
And we managed to get through that period. We managed to, you know, with a lot of preparation, you know, the clocks ticked midnight at the Millennium and the computers held up. And I think people sort of breathed a sigh of relief. And then a few months after that, we got this virus.
Whatever it was, wherever it came from, this virus was remarkable.
It was like a sort of auto-spreading computer virus. Really hard to stop, really contagious, and went around the world in a very short amount of time.
The U.S. military had essentially created the internet, and now it was being used against them. Within hours, the virus had penetrated international banking systems, more than a dozen federal agencies, and several large companies, including Jeff's, mucking up email servers all over the globe, all while secretly stealing internet passwords from millions of people along the way. It took days for some organizations to flush out the virus, and experts raced to understand the code causing all this chaos and to find whoever unleashed it. But a closer look under the hood did not reveal anything that advanced. It was your standard worm virus, code that corrupted files to exploit weak points in email software and internet browsers.
The virus technically wasn't cutting edge, but it's more than I could do in the year 2000.
What was cutting edge about this whole scheme was how it spread. For that, the virus relied on a different kind of weakness, human nature.
The way it worked was it would spread from email inbox to email inbox. And what happened was the virus would get sent to a particular individual, and there was an attachment with the tempting title, I love you. And the attachment looked like a text file. And so obviously as the recipient of the email, you'd think, oh my gosh, somebody loves me. You know, I'll open this mysterious, you know, non-Valentine's card and see who it is. What you didn't realize was that actually it wasn't a text file. It was disguised as a text file, and it was actually a piece of code. And when you opened that attachment, the code went into effect. And what it would do would be to scan your email address book and send itself automatically to the first 50 people in your address book. So they would all get a copy of this email, again, with the attachment on it. And of course, a bunch of them would click on the attachment and send it to 50 people and so on. Now, once you start doing the maths on that, you can take your calculator out and just give it a go. 50 times 50 times 50 times 50. You suddenly get to thousands upon thousands of infections.
New dangers tonight from the love bug computer virus. This is far from a childhood prank anymore. Experts say that the I love you virus could end up costing the world economy $10 billion in lost work time.
I think one of the things about the I love you virus that made it incredibly successful is it used two things, trust and curiosity.
Stephanie Carruthers is the chief people hacker for IBM's X-Force, a group of white hat or good guy hackers, analysts, and researchers who provide cybersecurity solutions for companies all over the world.
So when someone would open up their email, they would see it coming from someone that they knew and trusted. And then it played into their curiosity because the subject line or the file name was, I love you. It's like, okay, what does this mean? What's this all about? And I think that's incredibly impactful and something that we still do in today's world.
It's Stephanie's job to think like an internet scammer, to understand how people work. She says we all generally want the same things, and that makes us vulnerable.
Really, any type of scam at its core is social engineering. I mean, scams and cons have gone back even to the Middle Ages. If you've heard of the term pig in a poke, that's something at the time, local scam artists, they would find, instead of a suckling pig, which was valuable, that's what people were buying in a poke, which is a burlap sack, they would find like stray animals, right? Cats and dogs, sew them up shut in a burlap sack and sell that, but then they would just keep moving city to city so they wouldn't get caught.
The I love you virus was really the first to apply social engineering to internet scams, to use people's curiosity and that brief moment of tingling excitement to get them to click first and think later.
That's why we're still talking about it today. It affected, I believe, 10% of people who use the internet at its time, which is huge.
Compared to modern scams Stephanie deals with now, the I love you virus was quaint.
The ones that keep me up at night are the AI deepfakes.
Stephanie is constantly warning clients about fake phone calls, voice clones made to sound like friends or family in crisis, needing money.
To have those kinds of audio deepfakes be so successful terrifies me.
Hackers are still working with the same emotional playbook the I love you virus first scaled up for the digital age all those years ago, with an emphasis on trust and curiosity. Technology changes, people don't. The internet promised to connect the world, and the I love you virus, for the first time, exposed just how spectacularly dangerous that promise could be. Authorities scoured for clues about the mad genius behind it. A foreign adversary, perhaps. Some psychologically attuned terrorist organization, maybe.
The FBI does have some leads in the case, but is cautiously checking out reports that the I Love You author may be from the Philippines.
Digital forensic experts followed the data, where the code was funneling all those passwords scraped up by the virus.
Was stealing information from some of the computers it infected and sending those pieces of information back to a computer server in the Philippines, which was the sort of first indication as to where this virus might have set out from.
That's Jeff White again.
But it was very, very confusing because it didn't seem to be the work of a nation state, didn't seem to be the work of a computer hacking gang. All those types of attacks were sort of in their infancy at this point. So the actual purpose of it was really quite murky. In fact, it was sending so much data back to this server in the Philippines that the server actually crashed. It got overloaded with information that was incoming, which again was another indication that the person behind this virus didn't necessarily predict how successful it would be.
Authorities tracked down this server in the Philippines, which led them to a small group of computer science students in Manila.
A bunch of kids who were basically experimenting with different types of computer viruses. Now you've got to realize, you know, this was the days still of kind of floppy disks. And so they would pass around, you know, viruses to each other on floppy disks. There was a lab where they would work, where they would kind of swap bits of code.
And at this time, computer hacking was not a crime in the Philippines and in several other countries, because all of this was still so new.
And so when the investigators started looking and they started getting the names of some suspects within this university, who were these computer science students, who'd clearly been experimenting with these computer viruses, yes, they could identify some of the names that were likely in the frame, but they couldn't actually convict any of these people.
But the media was not ready to let this go. Press descended on Manila and focused their cameras and microphones on one particular student, the person most closely connected to the creation of the love bug, a young man named Onel de Guzman.
He had this bizarre moment where the lead candidate, the key suspect, Ernel de Guzman, is sort of paraded in front of the cameras, gave a very non-committal answer to the journalist's questions.
Ernel had long black hair, wore sunglasses, and held a cloth over his mouth as his lawyer took questions.
He's not really aware whether or not the acts imputed to him were indeed done by him, but he admits that he has been using the internet extensively.
And it's one of those moments where you sort of hang your head in shame at how bad the journalism was at the time, because you just wanted someone to throw the obvious question at him, you know, did you do it? But he managed to dodge that question, sort of shuffled out of the press conference, and then was never seen again.
Just like that, the world's foremost pioneer of hacking via social engineering disappeared. Jeff never forgot about him, though. And 20 years later, when Jeff started writing a book on cybercrime, he got a tip on Guzman's whereabouts.
He'd been hanging around working at a market in the Philippines, in Manila, working on a mobile phone stall in this marketplace.
Fixing cell phones for a living. So Jeff flew to Manila and scoured different markets for hours, armed only with a piece of paper with Guzman's name written on it.
And I showed the piece of paper to people, and most people thought I was just mad. But one person said, well, yes, I know him. One person sort of pointed down this kind of alley, and sure enough, went down there, you know, found the mobile phone stall, tapped this guy on the shoulder, and he turns around, and it's him, which was quite a surprise for both me and for him. So finally, you know, comes face to face with Ernel de Guzman.
Jeff matched the moles on his face with the moles he could see in that old press conference video. It was really him.
We sat down and we had a coffee, and he decided he was going to do an interview with me.
And that's when Ernel de Guzman admitted, for the first time publicly, that it was true. He did create the I Love You virus. He did send it out. It was him who crashed the communications of the world's most powerful army and countless others.
You know, he still seemed quite shy and quite reticent. He chuckled about things occasionally. He had a good sense of humor. He also said that he regretted what he'd done.
He told Jeff he didn't realize how bad this virus was going to get.
In fact, he says that after he unleashed the virus back in 2000, he went out and just got drunk and then woke up probably with a stonking hangover to discover that he'd caused worldwide mayhem and the police were banging a path to his door. You know, he basically at that point, he told his family to sort of trash all of his computers and just sort of went on the run for a little bit. So it was a pretty traumatic thing to happen. And I genuinely don't think he understood the kind of mayhem he was going to cause as a result of this.
But as to why he set the virus loose in the first place, why he tricked 10% of the internet and stole everyone's passwords, the answer was simple.
Ernel wanted internet access.
Back then, you were charged for internet access. Monthly fees usually billed to your phone line. Costs that were too high for a computer science student in the Philippines to afford.
So Ernel wanted free internet access. He's like, everybody else has access to this vast trove of information. I'm in the Philippines. I can't earn the kind of money that gives me, you know, the kind of internet access other people have. So if I can invent a virus that will go out and steal their passwords, I'll be able to log on to the internet using their passwords and then effectively hijack their internet connection and get the information that they can get. But that was what was the heart of it is, you know, he wanted information. He wanted it for free. He wanted what everybody else had.
That story was reported by Grant Hill.